As I introduced myself earlier, I'm an accountant lead. I've been there over 3 years now. A little bit about me prior to that is I graduated from Kent State in Ohio with a bachelor's in accounting. I started my career doing government auditing for 5 or 6 years, mostly of school districts and municipalities. So that's where the bulk of my experience comes from. After that, I moved down to Florida, took a position at Boar's Head, the deli and cheese company. One break came too much and decided to come back up north. So I found the lead, and he found me, and it's been great. At the lead, I'm responsible for the financial statements, a lot of grant accounting we get. What else? I do the financials for the Michigan Mayor's Association, the Attorney's Association, the Legal Defense Fund, and quite a few others. What else? Yeah, that's about it. And I also do some presentations, like I'm doing here. So. What we'll cover today.
Could you get the microphone just a little bit closer?
So what we'll cover today is quite a bit. I've looked at anything that's not on there. But so if you have questions, just kind of stop and let me know. We can just kind of. We'll start off talking about the purpose of municipal financial statements, the fund and fund balance, financial health and policies, and we'll kind of tie that into planning and budget. And then the last thing I kind of added to our presentation, I've done this presentation at Weekenders before, but not for a specific city. So I was like, well, let's just take a look at the Boyd financials and just see what I see from a former auditor. All good things. Oops, wrong way. Okay. So, the purpose of municipal financial statements, as we know, governments operate in a very unique environment compared to business. When someone goes to pay for a good or service, they pay their $5 and they get that perceived good back. Government works a lot different. It's based on an involuntary relationship and transaction between taxpayers and the services they get from the government. So it's very important to taxpayers and citizens that they see the value in what they're paying. And this is what municipal financial reporting aims to address, is the need to show stakeholders how the government has used their resources and if their ability to provide services has increased or deteriorated from year to year. We have two types of statements that are being found in your financials. We're going to briefly look at them, but the first are fund-based statements. Here on the following slide, the basics. And fund-based statements show how local government spends taxpayers' money. This is the balance sheet and the statement of revenues, expenditures, and changes in fund balance. And then there are government-wide statements that demonstrate whether the current set of taxpayers have paid the full cost of government services or not. And that is the statement of net position and the statement of activities. So, I'm going to look back at my mind. I can see the numbers clear. This is the Boyd City's balance sheet, April 30th, so the last year end, which is pretty unique, actually. I've never really seen an April 30th year end before. It doesn't really matter. Most cities and schools that I worked at were like 12/31 and 6/30, but so that's kind of unique. So what we have here on the balance sheet, you'll see there are three funds listed, and then there is an other governmental fund. We have the general fund, which is the primary operating fund of the city. We have special revenue funds. In Boyd's example, we have local streets and ambulance. I'll get into a little bit more about what special revenue funds are on a few more slides here. Also, fund balance we'll touch on as well. Also, part of the fund-based financial statements is the statement of revenues, expenditures and changes in fund balance. This, as you will notice, also has general fund, local street fund, ambulance, and other. And revenues you would expect to see, property tax, intergovernmental revenues, which are, in a nutshell, anything that comes from the county or state. And then, of course, expenditures, public safety, health and welfare, recreation, the typical expenditures that you would see. One thing to note on here, before we kind of move on to see transfers in and out, something to kind of touch on is that the general fund, think of it as almost a catch-all. So the general fund can transfer money to really anywhere And any fund that needs money. Special revenue funds cannot take money out. So these special revenue funds are designated for a specific purpose. And we'll touch on that a little bit more on the following slides.
I got one question for Mike, though. The timing, because I'm just learning calendar year and reporting IRS and all that stuff, some things that I'm doing personally, but with his comment that the calendar, the end year of April 30th, is there a reason why ours is specific to April 30th?
That's the way it was set up. I believe it might actually be in the chart with regards to it.
Yeah.
Okay. And it is kind of a unique time frame. I mean, it is possible to change it, but it would require some major amendments.
Right. Do you see like any advantage or disadvantage for that time frame being the end of the year?
I don't think it's the best in the world.
Right.
I think it's got some implications, especially, you know, with regards to the election. We have time, you know, new commissioners just getting on board. It is off from what other places are. There's no real advantage to us to have an April 30th time. And there might be other days that would be better. But that said, it'd be a real pain to change.
Right.
Yeah. The state has done something. They changed their fiscal year occasion, but they were usually doing that as kind of a trick to make up for shortages.
Right, I'm not in that situation. And that's why I was wondering why the time frame is on this, is if we're like a resort community and it helps us budgeting on certain infrastructure things around like seasonal, inclement weather.
I'm sure, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think it just had to do with the date that they picked at some point. Because when this would have been adopted, probably back in the 60s or
right.
Something of that nature, when our charters were originally set up, we weren't as strong. We didn't have the same financial influences that we do now, or
right.
The same priorities with regards to second homes and things.
Our schools, July 1st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most schools will be, here will be 6:30. And in Ohio, cities are mostly 12:31. So this was kind of unique, but the really point of it is to capture a 12-month snapshot. So there really isn't a... It would be a pain to change, though. I'd say it's best to change it. It's probably not. Wouldn't be worth it to change it. You have to restate financials for years. It would be a headache. So moving on, these are the fund-based statements, and these are all in the financial report here. That there's a lot, 100 and some pages, but these are the bulk of the statements we're going to look over. So these are the government-wide statements. This is the statement of net position. And you'll notice it's split into two types of activities. There are government activities, and there are proprietary or business-type activities. Everything that you think of in terms of government, at least in Boyne's example, outside of utilities, sewer and water, are going to fall under that governmental activities. Proprietary types are, like I said, typically in Boyne, I think it's just sewer and water. Are the main ones that you think you'll see. Component units up to the right, that's a totally different discussion. That's probably, I think, the Downtown Development Authority. And what a component unit is, it's basically the city's holding on to funds that they don't have the authority to spend. There might be another commission that chooses how to spend this money, but the city acts as a steward for those funds. That's what a component unit is. Lastly, I'm going to get up and kind of talk about this one. So this is the statement of activities. Now, this is government-wide. And it kind of reads left to right in a way. So I'm trying to speak up here. So here on the far left, you see we have expenses, our primary government expenses, our business type expenses, things you would see, public safety, community development. I'm going to focus on water rates and business type, just to elaborate how this works. So we talked about in business type, we have $1.8 million of expenses, and how do we pay for utilities? We charge the customers, they pay the utility bills. Falls under charges for services, $2.2 million. So Chris earlier mentioned water rates. Right at the top, from a bird's eye point of view, that tells me we're charging proper water rates. Because if this was negative, we would need to do some rate adjustments, which I typically don't see, but I have seen it before, where fall over here, this would be negative. So if you were having some sort of a water rate issue, this is just a bird's eye view of where that would pop out at. So like I said, following here are the expenses, and these are the types of revenues we can get. We can get charged for services. People can pay their water bills. Rec and culture, there might be some charges for services. I know there's a marina. What else? And then, of course, grants. Anything that is not covered, the charges for services, you'll see over here, is a negative value. That's pretty common to see things such as general government. I mean, these are services that aren't paid for by themselves. Where do we pay for them then? General purpose revenues, property taxes, we'll pay for the rest. So what the statement does is shows you where maybe certain departments or certain government activities have, are negative or positive, and where the catch-all for this is down here in property tax revenue. And as you can see, there was a 1.6 million increase in net position from year to year, which is very strong. Very, very strong. All right, so talked a lot about statements, and I've used the term funds a lot. General funds, special revenue funds, talked a lot about funds. So what is a fund? A fund is a accounting system for recording governmental transactions. Most people find the general fund to be the most important because most of the city's uncommitted resources will be there. And as I said before, you can transfer a little bit more wiggle room with the general fund as opposed to a specific revenue fund that may be legally restricted, whether it's, the internal, whether it's ambulance billings, that's your CMS billings going that fund and only that fund. That's supposed to be a beach in Point City. And I just put this on here because it didn't look like this coming up, and I've never been to one before, so I thought it'd be a little great to see some beach, some water. So hopefully I can bring my family up here and see the land a little bit. The real lead into this, though, is my accounting joke. Wait, where is it? Some fun in the funds at Boyne City. I gave up my standard comedy joke. I was doing the booth with my wife, and she's like, don't say that. Take that slide out. Anyway, so I'll tell you I got a couple laughs, so make me feel better. So some funds. Let's get back into the funds. There are three types of funds we talked about most of these already. Governmental funds, proprietary, and fiduciary. Governmental funds, think of your bread and butter. Police, fire, social services, things of that nature are going to fall under governmental funds, sewer, water, proprietary, and fiduciary. I won't pretend to know exactly what Boyne's fiduciary fund is, but they do have one, and as I talked about earlier, that's money that's not the city's, that the city is a steward of, so to speak. What else is there? So, debt service and capital projects, I can elaborate on a little bit. It's used to accumulate resources to pay down debt. Capital projects, if we need, obviously we don't need a new city hall, it's a beautiful city hall, but if you were to build one, you would put resources in a capital projects fund to save up for certain purchases. And even things aren't infrastructure, I believe, like if you were to purchase fire trucks, you might need to set aside some money in there, things of that nature.
Can you give an example of a fiduciary fund for Boyne City? Would it be like that Parks and Rec grant that we just applied for, where our property taxpayers are paying into that, and then we have the opportunity to draw that back from Shuttleworth County, or is that something completely different?
I think an example might be the fact that you collect the taxes for the school district,
yeah,
and you transmit those to the school district. So that's where the relationship would start while the subsidy gets performed.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Chris. Well, one more thing I'll kind of speak to about special revenue funds. You'll notice on one statement there was ambulance and local streets. There are more special revenue funds that one city has. What determines these, what makes them on the financial statements as, I'll go back here and go to the beach one more time. So what makes them special here as opposed to here is their major versus minor. Major special revenue funds are classified as that because of the amount of activity that goes through them. And as well as the dollar values. So what might be here might be 5, 6, 7, 8 special revenue funds. These are considered major because of the amount of dollars that go through them, and that determination is made through the finance department and audit team when they're putting together the financials. And this could change your year, it could stay the same. Just depends on your city and the activities that you have. All right, let's get back to where is that? All right, so we have our funds, our different types of funds, and what is fund balance? Fund balance is the measure of financial health of an individual fund. So think of it as, in a business, you have assets and liabilities, and you have equity. Fund balance is the government's equity. So how much fund balance is appropriate? Zero fund balance is not an option. Most cities, not about most, but a lot of cities will have a fund balance policy. I'm not sure if one does, but what a fund balance policy would do, it would outline a minimum target balance, where if your fund balance was getting to a worrisome level, there might be actions you could take to alleviate if the city was losing money. The best practice of fund balance is 2 to 3 months of expenditures. I think that's kind of what is recommended for a personal emergency fund as well. So ideal range is that 10 to 20% is the amount of uncommitted resources you should have in your city. I believe Boyne is around 30 or 40%, and it's close to 40%. So that's very healthy. That can also change based on your city. So maybe cities that are naturally larger might be able to trim a little more, whereas if a city is already operating very lean, they might want to keep that a little lower because there's only so much lean you can go. Some factors that play into the fund balance amount vary by city, such as the risk tolerance a city is able to have, as I mentioned, the size. If you have any large purchases coming up, that might play a role in how much fund balance you might want. And lastly, like I said, just the city goals. I know in the CAFR it talks about, in the annual financial report, it talks about a lot of those goals over there. I saw such as increasing housing availability and engaging our community. So maybe if there's initiatives you want to push forward, you might need to build up some fund balance for it.
Michael?
Yes.
So with the fund balance, so say you are putting money aside for capital purchases, new fire truck, EPW equipment, that sort of thing. Would that be subtracted from your fund balance that you've allocated to another account?
Yes, so what you could do is, for example, you would transfer that to like a capital improvement fund. If you were building a new city hall, you probably wouldn't make a giant transfer in 1 year. Over years, transfer money into a capital projects fund.
So would it be better to have a capital fund rather than a big general fund balance?
Yeah, it kind of depends on where it's going and the timeline of it. I don't know if you would want money sitting in a capital improvement fund and nothing's happening. For example, let's say you have a contract that's taking years, and a city hall is taking years to be built or something. You would put those funds in over a period of time. But if you're not building anything, I don't know.
I'm thinking more of like, the equipment's going to wear out every 7 or 8 years. Should you be putting a certain amount of money away each year for that new equipment?
Yep.
And if you did, then would that subtract out of your general fund balance?
It would, but you also have those assets now in the capital improvement fund.
So, like in our case, we do a lot of that funding through our motor pool for many of the assets, and now there's some departments that don't fund into the motor pool, but that's where some of those items go. Okay. A few years ago, we knew we were going to do something with the city facilities, and we were saving money. We knew we were growing the general fund balance very large. We ended up paying the DPW right out of that on cash.
Right.
Or we ended up using a good chunk of the fund balance for the open space project as well. Mm-hmm. That gives you flexibility, but you have to know where it's at. Sometimes if you tuck it away in certain areas, the commission may change their mind and want to try and pull it back, and sometimes that gets difficult. So there's pros and cons either way.
Exactly. Yep. And we kind of talk about, as we get into this, we talk about these fund balance classifications, specifically GASB 54. So GASB stands for Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And their goal is to make financial statements as a whole useful. Sometimes they make rules that are very useful, and sometimes they make some that are just big headaches for audit teams and cities. This one will have them very useful. So GASB 54 makes it so there are classifications. Clear classifications that be consistently applied. And there are these 5 classifications that funds can be placed into. The first is a non-spendable form. So what is non-spendable value? So think of prepaid expenses to be paid something in a future year. That's on your balance sheet as a prepaid. If you have inventory, that is bad. You can't go take your inventory and go buy a loaf of bread. These are values to the city that are non-spendable form. Restricted is a type, so it's part of a fund balance. It can either be any of these. The first, like I said, is non-spendable. Well, next is restricted, which is restricted by external legal restrictions. So if you got money, if you got grant money to use for, and I'm just thinking of things, to, you know, roads or ambulance or something, you, those funds would need to be restricted for that purpose, whether in that fund. Committed, and this is where the board or commission, city commission will come into play. Funds can be committed internally by an internal action. So these projects you mentioned might be coming up and you're thinking about it year after year as you do your long-term financial planning. You might want to commit funds through a form of board action. Assigned, funds can be assigned, and this is internally done typically through a city manager, finance department. It's not formal, but it does show up on the statement as an assigned balance, and this is what we want to use it for. That's really the only difference between committed and assigned. And then lastly is unassigned, and this is the residual balance. So this is money that can be used for really any purpose. And it should be noted that the governing body always has the authority to recommit funds. Always the unassigned balance. And you can't take restricted funds and put it where you want. But as far as the unassigned, you can move things around a little bit. All right. Are you questions on fund balance?
So our water, we did our water fund, Mike, it's got a really good...
We have water million?
Yeah.
Which water is stronger than the water?
Can you borrow, is it impractical to borrow that money? You know, the city just borrow from itself for anything?
Are you talking like utilities, for example?
Well, there's just a big, a healthy fund balance here.
Yep. So let's see. So this amount right here. So this would be on the general fund. This would be our the city's unassigned funds in the general fund. Each fund has their own categories of non-spendable, restricted, assigned, and unassigned. So like this amount right here. Through if you wanted to put it here, or somewhere here, you certainly can do that. But like I said, you can't take restricted money here and pay the general fund with it. Kind of a one-way street.
I think that's kind of the question he's asking with regards to wastewater funds or for an enterprise fund. Can they use that? Can you transfer that anywhere?
Yeah.
That's part of the question, and another part, specifically what he asked, I think, was can, like, wastewater serve as a bank and loan money to other funds?
Yeah, that's a question
you should ask your city attorney directly, because before you do it, you want to make sure you have the legal authority to do it. Okay. And I don't know what restrictions you have on that fund as we sit here.
And the quick answer is, we've done that before.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But the loaning fund, and I think it was wastewater in that case, we're able to justify it because they need interest on that. It wasn't just giving it away. They made interest, and they made more interest than they were making just in the regular market.
Okay.
So it saved the general fund money and made more money for the wastewater fund in that case. And it was still cheaper than going out and getting a loan from an outside bank. So we were able to loan ourselves, and that was reviewed by the attorney at that time.
I have a general question. Yep. The process of the user, actually the format that we use, is that a format that's used pretty universally?
When you say format of these statements?
The whole book there in front of Chris, is that...
This right here?
Well, that's our audit, but the budget, I don't know if that's the budget book, it looks like it.
But yes, it is.
Yes.
But is that a general format that's used by these 500 cities throughout Michigan?
There are quite literally a lot of different setups. This one is fairly comprehensive. So, you know, the fact that you see so much detail in here, and quite frankly, the achievement on financial reporting is an excellent tool. So, you're probably a little bit more than the average city going into this kind of detail. But it's actually the information that you actually need, set goals.
So part two of that is I think we do a good job, but is it, and it's so comprehensive, that is our staff spending almost too much time on it? Is there a streamlined process that would give staff more time to do other things? Even though we're doing an excellent job.
That's a million-dollar question.
There's no easy answer to that one. But I can tell you from actually handling situations for other communities that staying on top of your budget is one of the most important things you can do as a governmental entity, because when the state of Michigan comes in and takes over by way of an emergency manager, terrible things happen in the community.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the Flint example, in order to save, you know, 10 cents on, you know, water rate, they started dipping into the Flint River rather than getting their water from the city of Detroit, and that turned out to be a disaster. So while they were saving a couple of cents on a water rate and driving down the ultimate loss, they weren't considering health and human services in terms of what was that going to do to their general public. And by staying on top of your budget, you won't get into that situation where the state's going to come in and tell you how to run your city rather than how you're doing it yourself. I'm a pretty strong advocate, personally, this is not a legal opinion, by the way, strong financial management is like a must now for communities. And like I said, seeing it at this level of detail is pretty impressive, so you know where money is and where it's going and, you know, where, what your plan is.
The third part of that question is then we get criticized for saying, how come every gravel road is not paved? How come every city hole doesn't have water and sewer? You must be doing something wrong. I mean, it's kind of like catch 22. You do a good job and then you do your critics that don't understand the process. And it's hard to answer them without getting them to.
Yeah, for example, they want a paved road, but do they want to pay for the paved road?
Yeah.
I want it for free, and nothing in this world is free anymore.
Tim, did you want me to answer your question?
No, I was just saying that his second part was essentially, are we doing too much and should we have staff be pulling back on what we're doing there to save time for them to apply somewhere else?
My quick answer would be no. I think if there's one area we really want to be transparent on with our residents is where is the money going and can we show it to them and can they be comfortable with regards to it? I agree with Chris and Mike that's right. Got to be one of our number one.
You already made some criticism, but at least being able to show a lot of people that are rational that are going to walk through that and see where it's going versus if we didn't have that, then we're taking double criticism essentially.
Yeah, making a mistake is much more difficult if you really got a good plan and a really good budget. You won't get into that hole in the first place.
I mean, it's taking us extra time to get that reward for financial achievement. I mean, we do additional reports and things of that. That helps better inform the public by those that choose to read the report. Or hopefully just by showing that we're above many other communities that don't get that.
Right. It's well time invested.
I think so.
One of the perks of having a year or two ago, I was out of it. It changed. It used to be a comprehensive annual financial report. Now it's an annual comprehensive financial report. They switched to AMC. One of the benefits of having this is it does have the budget for all the funds listed in the back. So we talked about the budget being transparent. It should have. Yep. So like even all your fire special revenue funds, all those would be here with the budget. So being transparent is. How long does the budget season, so to speak, last, I guess? Is it
probably about 3 or 4 months.
That's
we start around the first of the year, and then the commission has to adopt it by the end of March. Or April. Yeah, April, before the May 1st.
I would say that's a very common timeline, it's 4 to 6 months, really. Alright. So financial reporting. So interim statements and audited statements are two different things. So, if you don't mind me asking, I guess, how often do you all see financial statements? Like quarterly, annually, just at the end of the year? I guess, like you as commission? Yeah.
That's got to be answered by these two. We've only seen it once.
Well, we see monthly financials.
Okay.
And it's a snapshot.
Okay. So that's essentially what this slide is going to talk about a little bit. Is you should definitely be looking at least some financial benchmarks, probably more than just at the year-end audit. So if you're looking at monthly or snapshots, that's probably prudent, especially with a city that's in a good financial standing like one city is. So what are interim financial statements? When you say a snapshot, you might be asking too, what do you mean, what is a snapshot?
Well, it's the end of the month financial statement for that day.
Okay.
And
it does have a snapshot of the year, though, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's monthly, year-to-date, okay. Budgeted.
And we've talked about it. I don't find it that useful.
Yeah, it's 45 pages of variable of a lot of stuff.
Okay.
So, I thought, would it be helpful if we had a subcommittee, I know two of us meet, or we can't have three, but to appoint one or two commissioners to review that with the city clerk treasurer to go through it, because it really is a lot to try to digest and try to figure out.
Mm-hmm. And you don't need to see that monthly all the time, or maybe there's only certain funds or certain activities that maybe the city commission is very interested that you want to see monthly, and then others maybe you don't need to. So what this slide is sort of just getting at is exactly what it sounds like you all see is a snapshot. So we should be seeing financials more than just at year end. Ask your finance department for certain information, whether it's we'll look at the next slide of an example I should pull from the back of your financials actually. So this is, I don't have any access to the city's internal books. I just pulled this from the back of the financial report. So for example, if you were wondering why, as a city, maybe this is something you didn't know, we budgeted amounts at 278 for the Boy and Thunder, which is this is a marina event that we're looking at?
Big boat race,
okay, that's the one, okay. So we might wonder, we started at 278, by the end of the year we realized we're gonna have like half of that, so we amended the budget to reflect that. And then we'll see April 30th, we came in and like half of that. So if somebody might not know why, you might wonder, finance department, can you please explain to me, why this happened? So I just took, my guess is there was a decrease due to COVID. I don't know, was that the reason
why? Yeah, that was canceled.
That was canceled, okay, so perfect.
Due to COVID.
That's why it's canceled. So this is just a total snapshot of the pulled. But the point being is that if there's certain information that you see from finance, certain trends that are disturbing, it's definitely not to be afraid to ask for information that you need. And in your case, maybe if you're having a 45-page packet, maybe it is a little too much a month, and maybe that 45-page packet comes quarterly.
One thing we don't do is approve accounts payable or anything like that.
I have seen, so regardless of dollar amounts, you guys don't typically see, because I have seen, have you seen, Chris, how many orders, certain amounts over, I don't know, 20,000, 15, you might need to go to council, because I've seen that before.
No, we appropriate the funds, it's just that we don't see the monthly activity.
Okay. I wouldn't say that that's uncommon.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that that's uncommon. This is just kind of like I said, as the year progresses, if you notice things going off the rails a little bit, not to be afraid to ask, because your finance department can give you really anything that you need. So, another reason that's kind of important, we talked about, Chris mentioned monitoring the budget, as we just talked about, it's a 4 to 6 month long process. So if you're not seeing your financials until you've already started budget season, you're probably, you might be out of the loop, or feel like your mail might be out of the loop. So keeping tabs on your financials throughout the year is kind of important for that process. And then we'll talk about the real statements briefly. The audit and audited financial statements. So you might be wondering, is there a review of an audit report? I assume.
We've been an audit report of months ago.
Okay. So typically, as a council person, what would be your role for your exposure in a financial audit? And it's typically not much. One of the main roles is to have an audit selection team, or if you guys ever probably haven't changed auditors in a few years, I'm guessing, but one of the roles would be to select your auditor. But beyond that, there are certain parts of the audit that will be exposed, will show exposure to you. One of them is the board minute review. So that's one of the first things audit firms do, is they'll review board minutes from
the begin first day of the fiscal year through the end of the field work. The review just to make sure that if you did have to approve a large purchase of $50,000 or more, they would look to see, oh, yeah, I see they purchased a fire truck. Did the board approve this? And if not, that would be, not like a finding, but that'd be like an audit write-up. So we'll typically look things of that nature. At the beginning of the audit, you'll also be asked about fraud. And it's a very simple set of questions, usually. When I was an auditor, we would typically ask administrators, a couple council members, are you aware of fraud? Are you aware of any areas susceptible to fraud? Things of that nature, because financial audits really don't uncover fraud. I think less than 5% of fraud cases are determined or found through a financial audit. Normally it's like a whistleblower, something of that nature, that exposes fraud. So the auditors are just doing their due diligence. So, I mean, I used to send just an email. I used to send a Word document to Tom. Hey, Tom, can you please fill this out and send it back to me? So that's something that you might see. And as far as the audit goes, it's really the only pieces that might come back to you. Except for lastly, there are some required communication to governance. There are two things that primarily audit firms are supposed to talk to be made known to the commission. And those two things are if there are any significant audit findings, ranging from material misstatements to disagreements and how an accounting principle was applied, or maybe even a disagreement in getting the information. Maybe they couldn't get the information, they had a hard time. So these are a couple of things that should be known to you. Judging off Boeing's history of audits and their GFOA awards, I don't think that's ever been a problem. So, but there is some required communication at the end of an audit. So like I've said, audit has several years of successful audits, and after reviewing the audits, I've noticed they're in very good financial health. But what are some things that an elected official can ask? Do you know if your community has debt and how much? And if so, what are the terms? What are the available reserve balances that we talked about? Does the community have a history of meeting its budget? And does the community have a long-term financial forecast? Which it certainly does. Is everybody kind of aware of some of these questions or some of the community going on?
So would you ask these questions at the city commission meetings?
Okay, so that might be where you kind of, is there any, that's a question I'm not really sure, is there any financial information that maybe they should or shouldn't answer in or outside of a meeting that you're aware of? Or?
Well, it always is best to ask the source, so talking to the finance director. Again, I'm not sure how administration handles it here. The city manager in the community that I used to be mayor of, had pretty much an open door policy for, individual council members to talk to the finance director if they had a question. My friend that used to try to embarrass the finance director always had it turned around on him, when he'd ask those silly questions, the gotcha questions, and she'd have the answer right, if you read page 14, it's right there in front of you, kind of thing. The communication can be either at a commission meeting or, just call you up on the phone and say, hey, I was looking at this in the financial statement and it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Talk to the city manager, talk to the finance director, and it might be a very logical, easy explanation. And generally, it gets resolved at that level. So it doesn't have to be done. You'll find if you start taking every little question to a commission meeting, your meetings will stretch on forever. And that doesn't do you any good either, because as I mentioned before, you make some really bad decisions at 1 in the morning. those are long, terrible meetings and you don't really want to go there.
All the information that was just on that last screen is information that's available to anybody that wants to look in the budget presentation book, the budget book that each of you have, or in the office. None of that secret information or anything of that nature. And those are all real easy questions to answer, and we shouldn't have any problem with that. We put it out there for people to see.
Okay.
briefly ask a little bit about the budget, so we're going to kind of come to a close here with the financial planning and budget and how they kind of correlate with each other. So financial planning combines financial forecasting and strategizing. It is a highly collaborative process that tries to plan out future scenarios for the needs of the city, and is updated as material conditions change. It's a process that projects revenues and expenditures over a long period of time. And the goal of financial planning is to align your financial capacity, the revenues you're receiving, with the output that you are producing to your citizens in terms of service objectives. Which I believe on one of the first pages of the CAFR, of the annual comprehensive financial report, it does talk about the city's long-term financial plans and goals, so it's good to see that that's on the forefront. And I believe there are all of those right there. So understanding the budget, we talked about earlier, budgets for businesses and budgets for government are, the whole operation is different, so obviously the budget would be too. Businesses tend to think of budgeting from a revenue side of things. I know this when I was at Boar's Head, if we needed to make more money, we added 10 more cents to the turkey and we were making profits. You can't really do that. You know, your property taxes more or less are what they are, so you really need to be a little bit more expense focused. The expenditure side of a budget is called an appropriations, and beyond the budget, this is actually the legal authority for the city to spend money. So if you haven't passed the budget appropriations measure, you can't legally spend a penny. So think of it this way too, as an appropriation also might not be a forecast. It's, like I said, it's the maximum amount that you can spend. So if there's a department that's coming in way under budget every year, it might not be that they're sandbagging or that they're just, you know, they might have this appropriation because who knows, maybe a bunch of equipment goes. And if that's not appropriated in that particular manner or something, they can't spend it. So that's kind of a way to look at it from an expense side of things. So where planning does mean budget, we just kind of talked about. What are you trying to do in this city? Are you trying to improve services? Are you trying to sustain services? A very large capital expenditures coming on the horizon. City initiatives such as RRC. I noticed the financial report talks about Boeing being a ready, redevelopment-ready community. One of my very first tasks actually, I believe, was under the county MDC in the lead, and it was for a project in Boeing. I think they're doing a parking needs study, and they also did some drilling to see if land was okay for construction, I believe. I'm not sure where in the city. I just know that...
It's the Boschman lot.
Okay, that's what it was. So that was one of my first jobs in the league, was working with MEDC and getting the bills made. So it's good to see that the city is taking advantages of opportunities like that. And lastly, we kind of talked about the forecast. It should be 3 to 5 years. It should be more than, I would think probably 7 or 10. It's probably getting a little too long because then we don't know what's going to happen. I don't think anybody thought COVID would happen, and here we are. So it's important to keep your budget within a reasonable amount of time. Just briefly, these are things that you might not need to look at or know. There's certainly things that I believe a city should have, and most cities have these types of policies, purchasing policy, specifically a credit card policy. I don't know if your city has one, but when I was auditing, saw a lot of kind of a lot of credit card abuse, there are a lot of unchecked credit card purchases, so that would be something to make sure a city financial department has or controls on that. Investment policies, debt policies are pretty self-explanatory. They guide the city's debt and investment principles. A capital asset policy would determine what items are a capital asset and what are not. A capital asset is an item that is purchased and depreciated every year, whereas an item is purchased that's not a capital asset, it's just expense. And lastly, as we talked about, a fund balance policy is important. So Boeing, I think, has 40% or so unassigned fund balance, so money to use. But maybe things take a turn, and maybe one day we don't, and that creeps down to 30 and 20. You might want a fund balance policy in place to kind of be proactive in the event that were to ever happen.
Do we have
one? Oh, I was going to say two things with regards to Mike's comments. With regards to credit cards, the city doesn't have any credit cards, so I don't want to have a risk with the fraud. For the pizza, it went on my card, and it'll get reimbursed. And there's a process to check that. So that's where we are with credit cards. fund balance. The policy that has been established by the commission is maintaining a 25% minimum fund balance.
Very strong. It's a very strong number. Yeah, no, I remember I was working on, I was out in the city on the east side of Cleveland, and they had their own like, gas pump and everything. Or they had gas cards, they're passing out gas cards to their buddies and stuff. But I'm going through these cards, like, there's no way you guys are spending all this money in gas. And it turns out that they were passing gas cards around to all their buddies and things of that nature. So it always pops in my head of just, you know, kind of an easy control. Or if you're going to have, like Mike said, have to kind of concentrate into one or two or three people that have that access. Just something to be aware of. And lastly, there are resources available to you in terms of questions and things that we had today, or questions for Chris. There's us who can talk to, peer entities, cities nearby, the GFOA, Government Finance Officers Association, as well as state laws and regulations are always places to turn. So lastly, I kind of talked about kind of just what I noticed from kind of Boyne City financials. We talked about earlier the sewer water rates look strong. I think it was a $400,000 increase of revenues over expenditures in that fund. So, no, we don't need to lower water rates because things happen, things need replaced, things of that nature. So, that's it was an appropriate amount. The ACFR, the annual comprehensive financial report, I think one's done that for, I think it's been in the report, it mentions the past 5 years that they've got that award. It sounds like it's been kind of a long standing thing. And what that is a city that doesn't do an annual comprehensive financial report, this might be like half. There's an annual comprehensive financial report shows statistical data. It might show tax-based information. It might show who are your city's top 10 employers, things of that nature. So really, it's just a real deep snapshot, a deeper snapshot of the city and what's going on. It gives the city a chance to talk about what initiatives they have. And things of that nature. So somebody who's really in tune to what the city's doing would get a lot of information from that. And that's the only way to get the GFOA award is to have that annual comprehensive financial report. One other thing I noticed, there's multiple years of increasing that position. I think almost 10 years of continuous net position growth. So the city's been looking very strong. As I mentioned before, I think 51% of the city's funds are on the side, and 44% of that is in the general fund. As Michael just mentioned, the fund balance is 25%. That's what policy calls for, so things are looking very strong there. And lastly, I like Tyler talked about in this talk about the city's financial plans. And as I mentioned before, you've utilized some other resources as well. So, if there's any questions, I can take them now, or if not, there's some kind of business card, we want to write that down. You can feel free to ask any questions at the time.
Do you have an opinion on the MNL wage and salary survey? If that's worth participating in?
Do you know more about that, Chris? I can't honestly say that I don't know about that. Only Andy does that, right?
Yes, he does. I think it's a valuable tool, especially as you get into union negotiations, especially. Police unions are very good at sharing information among themselves, you know, who gets paid what where, and it's nice to have the same information. And our survey, you know, was statewide, so, you know, you don't want to compare yourself to what's happening in, you know, the city of Troy, because, you know, very big and well built out at this point. But you want to look at communities your size, the size of the force, that sort of thing. So it gives you a good benchmark if you're in the ballpark for that, I think. Guess I should ask you, did you want to take another quick break before we get into the LMA?
I'm good. I don't know. We can take a break 5 minutes?
Or? Yeah, I'm good. I just had one other question, more along the lines of like your experience. So for example, I think at the last city commission meeting, you had this auditor for 10 years, and he's a great auditor. A lot of the conversation we had with him, he was able to pull the numbers off the top of his head without having to go through the book. But from your experience, at what point in time should a city commission collectively think when is the best time to look for bids and not look for bids. I'm tenure with being partnership or doing different services for the city. Should we be looking for bids like every 5 years, every decade, just to try and get a grasp on where we are ethically with other services?
That's an interesting question. Professional services are unlike almost everything else. The ultimate problem with doing like a cycle every 5 years, we've got to go to see who's the best auditing firm. If you are working with a good auditor right now, you trust the auditor has provided you great service, I wouldn't arbitrarily say, oh, every 10 years we've got to go put it out for bid. Remember, too, that the experience of a firm isn't transferable to somebody else. So if you bring in somebody, there is a long ramp up to understanding what the person you just let go knows. So, you know, somebody might know something off the top of their head, as you mentioned, but a new firm is going to take, oh, wait a minute, let me get back to you on that. Oh, let me get back to you on that. And it'll take a number of years to get back up to where the firm was. So I'm not of the opinion that you should cycle it in at any particular random number, like 5 or 10. Now, obviously, if you're not happy with the service, you know, the auditor comes in and doesn't know what they're doing, then he may change. But that's where I would leave that in my opinion.
It's interesting to bring up audit. When I first went to Michigan, I learned this because I asked Sherry, my boss, like, who's our auditor? And this, that, and the other. In Ohio, you had to change auditors. I think it was either 5 or 7 years. You could not keep the same auditor for a long period of time. Or what would happen is you'd have it for 5 or 6 years, the state would come in for 1 year, check on things, and then you can go back to your contract or whatever. Which team does not have that. So it would be interesting because, you know, for outsiders point of view, you might want to think like, oh, maybe we do need to mix it up. Maybe the auditor would see something. But you're right, like the lead up time, just having to get a new audit team would add, it would be a headache. Every time we meet, we take over a client for the first time, you got to go back to their books for the past couple of years. It's kind of a nice perk, I think, in Michigan. You know, you kind of keep your auditors and stuff.
All right. Next, we'll get to the Sunshine Laws, Part 2, which is the Open Meetings Act. Once again, we got here because of Watergate. And I think this is probably one of the most misunderstood parts of the meeting. And so I'm going to actually read this question to you. The public body includes a board, commission, committee, or subcommittee. So all these things that boards have typically tried to do, even the regents at the University of Michigan fell into this trap, was, oh, we'll get a non-quorum group over here, a non-quorum group over here, a non-quorum group over here, and we won't violate the Open Meetings Act. Wrong. Subcommittee is included. So if they're doing governmental things, like narrowing down what your options are, or choosing three of the best ones to take to the commission, that's a committee. It's a subcommittee, and it has to come under the auspices of the Open Meetings Act. Literally, if you put two people on that interview team, now you have to have an open meeting in that interview. So you kind of messed that whole process up by definition. And people started focusing on, you know, do I have a quorum or not as being the issue. And that's wrong. If it includes a subcommittee that has some sort of governmental power, like we're going to deliberate toward a decision that the whole commission needs to make, that's kind of a fundamental error and has gotten boards in trouble, including the University of Michigan's Board of Regents. So again, the policy of the Act is similar to FOIA, which is to strengthen the rights of people to understand what their government is doing. by making all, well, nearly all of its business done at an open meeting. And I got to tell you, courts in the state of Michigan have been very, very consistent on this. If you read this particular sentence from a judge's report on a case from the Court of Appeals, you know, we will not countenance the use of strained legalisms or evasions to undermine the intent of the OMA. Courts are very, very consistent in this respect. So, let's go over the basic requirements. It requires that most meetings of a public body shall be held in an open meeting. It requires that any decision that the public body makes be done in an open session. You may have certain discussions in a closed session, properly called a closed session, if that's needed, but when you finally make the decision on whatever it is, that has to be done at the open meeting. And unless there's a specific exemption in the Open Meetings Act, you must conduct the business in a public meeting. So if the public body is meeting with a quorum present, or even a constructive quorum, and that's what the U of M Regents ended up doing, trying to obey the Open Meetings Act, and it's convened for the purpose of deliberating toward or rendering a decision on which a vote is ultimately needed by the public body, the Open Meetings Act applies. And that includes all your committees and subcommittees, groups of two can be a subcommittee. The courts have defined deliberation specifically as any discussion leading toward a decision. So it can be not only, you know, actually deciding things, but it might be narrowing down the options. You know, there's 20 ways of getting from here to there. Which of these 20 ways make the most sense? Well, let's recommend these three to the city commission. And these are our rationale for recommending these three. That meeting has to be open, where you're narrowing down from 20 to 3. So it's important that you understand that deliberating is narrowing down your choices as well as expanding them out. Let's have a meeting where everybody can tell us what they think. That needs to be an open meeting as well. Once again, the constructive quorum has gotten a number of communities in trouble where, you know, somebody pops in and out of a meeting that hadn't been intended to be a meeting at all, but all of a sudden people are starting to talk about that government's business, so it becomes a real problem. Now, there's a lot of requirements in the Open Meetings Act that you really do have to follow, like religion, literally. First of all, after your first regular meeting of the year, and it can be in your fiscal year, it could be a calendar year, it's your choice. There's no rhyme or reason to it, other than it has to be one of those two. Within 10 days of setting your first meeting schedule, your regular meeting schedule needs to be posted. And by the way, a lot of this can be done on the website, but the website needs to be updated on a regular basis to make sure that your meetings are all listed. If you change the meeting, for example, nobody noticed that on a particular day you set a meeting, it happens to be President's Day, and you don't want to meet on President's Day, for example, you may change that meeting from Monday to Tuesday. Fine, but within 3 days of changing that meeting, you have to post the revised meeting schedule. And it has to be done. And if you have scheduled a special meeting or reschedule a regular meeting, you need at least 18 hours, literally 18 hours, before you can have that meeting. I have defended too many cases where the judge is sitting there lecturing me, "Can't your clients count, Mr. Johnson? One, two, three." You know, and it gets ridiculous, you know, what they'll do, but they will punish you for missing 18 hours. And do the 18 hours have to be where the city hall is open for 18 hours? No, but if you post a notice you know, on the window that anybody can see, or on the website where anybody can see, probably in good shape. You have to keep minutes of the meeting. And this is what's required under the statute, the date, the time, the place, the members that were present, the members that were absent, and any decisions that are made. And if you're going into a closed session, the purpose of the closed session, any roll call votes that you take must be listed with who's voting yes or no, or aye or yay. That is all that is required under state statute for minutes. And let me give you an example. Minutes are not a court transcript. There's a whole different need for a court transcript where you write down everything that anybody says. That's a court transcript. Minutes of a meeting need these particular items in it. They don't need the fact that Chris Johnson talked for 22 minutes and he said A, B, C, D, and E. And when I became mayor in my community, I noticed they were spending a good 20 minutes arguing about the minutes because there was one council member that liked to be quoted extensively, and then he would say something at a meeting, and then the next meeting argue about that he didn't say that in the minutes of the meeting that they were being approved. His comment didn't need to be in the minutes at all, and I made sure we changed that, so we took off the half an hour of the meeting that was undoing all the old problems and that they created because we were going too late. And I took off almost another half hour, so they were arguing about the minutes. So you saved an hour of meeting time just by two little changes. So it's not a court transcript. Don't fall into that trap. Generally describe what the discussion was. You know, the commission discussed X about this problem, and maybe a two-line blurb or paragraph, but it doesn't need to be Joe said this, Sam said this, Mary said that. You know, that's a court transcript. That's not a set of minutes. Public comment is always interesting, as we saw tonight. Citizens do have the right to address the meeting and to tape or video record the meeting. That's right in the statute. However, you as a city may establish reasonable rules for doing that. So, you establish what your rules are, just remember to enforce them fairly. It'll be real obvious to the general public if you're not enforcing them fairly. You have a 5-minute, I think I heard 5 minutes. Everybody gets their 5 minutes. They shouldn't get 22. They should get their 5 minutes. That's just reasonable.
Should they get a second 5 minutes?
No, they don't get a second 5 minutes.
Okay.
You also can only remove a person from a meeting if they're committing a breach of the peace at that meeting. So Chris Johnson comes to your meeting, I'm being a total idiot, finally have to be interviewed by the police chief because I'm just not letting you conduct the meeting. You can't keep me from coming in the next 2 weeks later and say, oh, you were an idiot at the last meeting, you get out of here. They have to commit the same sort of breach of the peace another time and they can be removed that way. I did have a community that at one time had a person, I'll phrase it that way, a person that liked to disrupt the meeting all the time. And he was probably removed from meetings maybe 20 different times in a year. They wanted to get an injunction to prevent him from coming into the meeting. And we're unsuccessful, even though this individual had totally abused the system. There isn't a court that will interpret the Open Meetings Act as being anything. If you get out of line in this meeting, we'll remove you, but that's the only way you can do it. You can limit where the public comment happens at a meeting. You can place it anywhere on the agenda that you choose. It could be at the beginning of the meeting. It could be during the meeting. It could be at the end of the meeting. I'll give you a little practical advice from a political standpoint. If you do it at the end of the meeting, after you've made all the decisions, you'll have a very unhappy public. There might be different results at the end of the next election season. So if you've already made up your mind and haven't listened to the public on anything, and that's when you give them a chance to speak, you'll have a very angry group of people. But you literally may do that under the Open Meetings Act. You can restrict the time of individuals, but you can't restrict the total amount of time that's spent in public comment. As I used to look out at my crowd, we had 50 people show up, we knew we had a problem, and we were going to hear it from the community. You can use this technique, and I found it was very, very valuable. When you've heard basically the same thing being said by three or four citizens, you can go, "Hey, Mr. Smith, what you're trying to tell the commission here is that A and B and C, correct? And try actively listening to these people so that you get it accurately." And that's why you kind of spell it back to them, because you've actively listened. Yeah, those were the three things that I was really trying to tell the commission about. Okay. Now, everybody that's here, who agrees with Mr. Smith? Raise your hand. You'll be amazed. Three quarters of the audience will raise their hand. Be fair. So who disagrees with Mr. Smith? And maybe one or two hands will shoot up. The audience has now participated. The audience has told you what they think. Three people have already gotten up and said the same thing, and now, 40 of the 50 are agreeing with that particular position. You'll find that they won't need to all come to the microphone and say the same thing again. There might be a few that will want to do that, and you have to let them do that. They get their 5 minutes, but the need for them to do that kind of goes away if you've actively listened and shown that you listen. So it's a good technique that I found. It's very valuable. Now let's get to the closed session calling and symposium. You always start off every meeting with a COVID meeting, even if you're going into a closed session. And you need a motion to go into closed session, a second, and then adopting that motion to go into closed session. Two of the six reasons for going into a closed session only require a majority vote, but I still recommend doing it on a roll call vote, simply because it develops a good habit for you. And a closed session is one of those things that does deserve the attention of a roll call vote. But for discipline of an employee or official, whether it be an evaluation, discipline, suspension, that sort of thing, that can be done with a majority vote, as well as going into a session for collective bargaining. The other four exceptions require a two-thirds roll call vote to go into closed session. And the roll call vote and the purpose for calling a closed session should be in the minutes, in the motion itself. So I move to go into closed session to discuss collective bargaining agreement with the police union. A second, and then a roll call vote on that before you go in. Now, I'm going to take these in the order of the statute. These are not in order of importance. Just so you know, I'm not trying to give you anything other than the order of the statute here. But if requested by the person who's the subject of the potential discipline or review, they may request a closed session. It's not the option of the city commission. It's the option of the individual. I recommend that you get it in writing, because if there's ever a dispute, it's nice to have a piece of paper to hold up to a judge. Look, George Simons. And, it makes that question go away.
Really. And the person who's requesting the closed session put it in writing.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's what I'm suggesting you do, because, if, for example, the person changes their mind during the closed session, you have to go back out into open session. So it's the person that's the subject of the discipline that gets the choice. The next section in the Open Meetings Act for a closed session is for strategy and negotiation sessions involving the collective bargaining agreement. So that is kind of obvious. I always recommend that unless you're trying to reopen a contract, that you actually do it sometime within a reasonable time frame of going into those sessions. Because you can go into a closed session to build consensus and strategize on a collective bargaining agreement before you actually get to the negotiation. Next item is to consider the purchase or lease of real property. Again, I think the purpose here is pretty obvious. If you were looking at buying a piece of property at Main Street and Elm Street, you're probably in a situation where once the owner of that property finds out that you're interested in it, they think the city's flush with cash, has more money than, you know, any other potential buyer out there, and the price triples, quadruples, or sometimes just really skyrockets. And that's to prevent that from happening. I would note, though, that the sale of real property is not the subject of a closed session. So you own a piece of property that you don't need anymore. All those discussions need to take place in an open session. The next one under the statute that you can use is to discuss with your attorney regarding trial or settlement strategy regarding specific litigation. So Chris Johnson has sued the city. You can meet with your attorney to discuss the case of Chris Johnson versus the city. Again, you also need the two-thirds roll call vote to go into that closed session. And I remember having to speak to a city council one time. They couldn't get the two-thirds of the vote and then wanted me to discuss it with them in an open session. And what I had to tell them was their police department had messed up pretty badly. And if I told them in a public session what they wanted me to, they wanted to embarrass the police officer and the chief at the time, but I wouldn't do it. I turned around and I left the meeting because I knew the price of the settlement would skyrocket that day, and I wasn't going to be a party to that. And they had my written report anyway. The next closed session is to review applications for employment. If the candidate requests confidentiality. And the reason here, again, is obvious. If there's some communities out there that if they suspected that a staff member was looking at a different job or trying to improve themselves by getting more money in a different position or just expanding their role somewhere, they'd fire or her. It's just... that's the way they would do business. So it's to protect that applicant just through the application and vetting stage. If you get to the point where you are actually interviewing the applicant as the city commission, that has to be done in a public meeting. So it's important to recognize that the interviews can take in the open meeting, but you can vet the applications, again, if the candidate requests confidentiality. And the last exception to the Open Meetings Act is to consider material that's exempt from discussion and disclosure by state or federal statute. So, if, for example, you're going to review security plans for how you would defend the water treatment plant in the event of an incident, you can review those plans in a closed session, because they wouldn't be obtainable under a FOIA request. An appraisal, for example, is another item. It's not to be disclosed until you've actually purchased the property or if there's litigation involving obtaining the property. So those appraisals would be the subject of a closed session if you're reviewing them. A written opinion by your municipal attorney. The city attorney has been asked a question, gets certain facts from you, writes the opinion, says, you know, I think you should do A, B, or C, and these are the reasons why. You can go into closed session to review that. So that's another avenue that you're likely to come into contact with. You need to keep a separate set of minutes for a closed session. And here I'm a very big advocate of a minimalist situation where the minutes should be pretty bare bones. commission. These were the commissioners there. This was the time the meeting started. We discussed, you know, the collective bargaining agreement with the City Police Department Officers Association. And that's what the minutes say, you know, there's not a whole lot in there, or shouldn't necessarily be. Those minutes are kept by your clerk or designated secretary, and the minutes should only be disclosed if ordered by the circuit court, separate proceeding, so you don't share those minutes. And if necessary, you can go into closed session to discuss the minutes of the closed session. But if you keep them down to basic minimum, like I recommend, it shouldn't be a little up to discuss. And you may destroy the minutes of the closed session 1 year and 1 day after this is approved. So if you approve the meeting minutes in January 2nd, you can destroy those minutes. If the court has an order to be produced 1 year and 1 day, that would be January 3rd, the next year.
If the court, if they are released by court order, do you have to retain them for more than a year?
You'll have to retain them as long as the court orders that. As a practical matter, you're not, as a practical matter, since other people will have them, it makes sense to hold on. There's nothing worse than litigation where somebody has something that I don't. And I've had that happen to me. Oh, we sent those minutes off to so-and-so. And as I mentioned before, closed sessions are confidential, and what happens in the closed session should remain confidential. The Attorney General has actually given an opinion that says the public official risks criminal and civil penalties if they disclose closed session minutes, and I think a number of municipal attorneys agree on the concept that if you are disclosing the contents of the meeting, you're still in that same problem. But think about it, each one of these particular exemptions exists for a reason. And, you know, you might be disclosing to your lifelong friend that they're interested in purchasing your property, but by letting that person know, even though they've been your lifelong friend, you cost the city an amazing amount of money, and it just didn't appear to the taxpayer. So keep the discussions confidential. And these are other potential violations. If you disclose the contents of a meeting, you could violate your ethics ordinance if you have them, rules of conduct if you have them. Could be a charter provision. I haven't reviewed it in detail for that. It certainly violates Robert's Rules of Order. Most communities do operate under some forms of Robert's Rules. Could be a violation of the State Ethics Act, possibly too. So just be smart, keep it confidential. So this is kind of where life gets fun. And again, this act was passed in 1976, and we have totally different technology than we used to have in 1976. I kind of like the tease with this photo saying, you see that awful wreck down there, and all those people looking on are our state legislators who just, you know, kind of looking at it and going, oh, not my business. Well, it is their business because the Open Meetings Act is a state statute. So it might be time to bring it into the year 2022.
It's related to auto insurance reform.
Again, these things were not available when they wrote that particular act. So you have to realize that you can deliberate electronically. So let's say we get into a situation where a commissioner comes up with a great idea and sends out an email to all the other commissioners. Well, you've been trained in business lately to hit reply all, and the reason why you do is so that everybody knows what you're thinking of in business. And so there's no surprises. But the problem is, once somebody starts hitting the reply all feature of an email, you're deliberating, because you're either throwing out the ideas, discussing the ideas, sharing it among the entire council or commission, and you know, even though you've been trained in business to do that, you violated the Open Meetings Act. There's another one. Social media kind of falls in this category too. So one of you decides to have a Facebook page, fine. You come up with this great idea that the city should implement, fine. But all of a sudden, other council members start liking it or disliking it or, you know, chiming in with their own comments. You get a majority of your council on a Facebook page doing that, and again, you violated the Open Meetings Act. And the reason why is right here. None of the requirements of the Open Meetings Act are followed. It might be totally open if it's on Facebook, but you still violated the Open Meetings Act because you didn't follow the Open Meetings Act rules. When I say follow religiously, I mean that almost literally. Post the notice, allow the public to be there, have the public comment section. None of that is taking place either on Facebook or on an electronic email blast that's going around. We had a case in our firm that came in that was a recreation commission, and four of the seven members wanted to do a particular thing, and they strategized in the round-robin email. You know, I'm going to do this, and you do that, and then this person will do this, and da-da-da-da-da. They basically scripted out the whole meeting, and three of them were actively participating, and the fourth one was just on the email chain. And they argued that that didn't violate the Open Meetings Act because, you know, they didn't have a quorum talking in email. Well, the circuit court judge disagreed throughout all their action and made them start all over in an open meeting. Luckily, they didn't get fined or sent to jail. Which kind of gets to my next point, which is the consequences for violating the Open Meetings Act. Any person, including the newspaper or media, may bring a civil action to challenge the validity of what you do. So while you may have the option of reenacting it at a public meeting, which will go to mitigate some of it, you still have the problem of if you violated the Open Meetings Act, they can void the action. They can just throw it out. The judge says, sorry, you know, you did it improperly, you didn't give notice, you didn't do this, whatever. Throw the action out. And then we have this, again, from the Attorney General, and I've given you the citation to it, you know, they're risking criminal prosecution and civil penalties by disclosing closed session minutes. Here's the difference between the Open Meetings Act and the Freedom of Information Act. Freedom of Information Act has a lot of penalties in it that are related to crime and fines. The Open Meetings Act has a section that says it's a criminal misdemeanor to violate the Open Meetings Act. You can get 90 days in jail, $1,000 for a year, $2,000 for subsequent violation. Quite frankly, that's a scary, scary thought. You didn't get elected to go to jail. You didn't get elected to violate the Open Meetings Act. But if you intentionally do that, you're looking at some really serious stuff. And the current Attorney General has been quoted in a press conference by saying if she becomes aware by anybody reporting it that a public body has violated the Open Meetings Act, she's coming after you. And we have never had an Attorney General that made a statement like that in public, making you public enemy number one if you violate the Open Meetings Act. So she's pretty serious about that. Now we had COVID-19 kind of disrupt the Open Meetings Act, and we had the governor issue a bunch of executive orders, and there were a number of lawsuits that challenged the governor's authority. The Michigan Supreme Court, as I was talking about before, the courts also influence what we do on a regular basis. The court basically said that there were two acts that the governor was trying to use, the Emergency Powers of the Governor's Act and the Emergency Management Act of 1976. And the court ruled that the governor is required to receive the consent of the legislature to to extend any emergency orders that the governor issued beyond 28 days. And the court also ruled that the 1946 Emergency Powers of the Governor Act was unconstitutional because it gave too much legislative authority to the governor. So as a result of that, there was a change in the Open Meetings Act that allowed for virtual meetings in Public Act 228 in 2020, and that act has been amended at least two times. Virtual meetings were allowed for any reason for any reason for a period that ended December 31, 2020. After that, there was a period of time where you could declare a local emergency or attend via electronic means if you had your own health issue or family health issue. Unfortunately, that work expired on December 31, and we still are now required to be personally as opposed to virtually. Quite frankly, I find this appalling. I don't understand why the House of Representatives, for example, is not meeting this week because of COVID concerns, but they're making you meet in person rather than virtually. I don't get it. If you've had any family member that's tried to get into a hospital recently, and I've had that unfortunate problem, you spend 48 hours in the emergency area waiting to get a bed up in the hospital, being part of the hospital. The legislature might think COVID and the pandemic is over, but it's not. Just go to your local hospital. So, my first rule of public service is, it's not fun if you're sitting in jail. So this is one of those statutes you have to be very aware of, and make sure you follow it religiously, and make sure that you don't become that most unfortunate public official to do jail time for actually violating the Open Meetings Act.
Did you have that happen?
Not to my knowledge. It hasn't happened to me yet. Some pretty strange penalties, like a circuit court judge in Genesee County required a city council to go on a traveling roadshow within the entire county and show up at several board meetings and explain how they messed up with the Open Meetings Act. That would be the Robin Roberts type thing that we were talking about earlier that the regents at the University of Michigan had used. So, now, there have been some times when we've been really humbled by the circuit court judge, but to my knowledge so far, they haven't found a jail. You don't want to do it. Here's some other resource materials that are available to you for the Open Meetings Act. Again, we have a lot of stuff available to you to use and to And with that, any questions you have on any items that we discussed today?
Well, I was just going to ask a follow-up to yours, Hugh, there. So as you were going through that, Hugh asked about anybody sitting, on a selection committee for department head, and then just in that last bit there, you said, and your answer was that if he were to sit with Mike at a selection, there'd be, two officials on there that would be violating the Open Meetings Act, and then it said, well, in the interview process, it's an open meeting anyhow, so you can't.
No.
Okay.
There's two things to keep in consideration. When the selection is being made by the commission, the selection of a city manager, for example, you can accept applications for employment and keep those confidential. But when you decide you're going to interview Mike and Chris and Dave and George, you've changed the dynamics. You're now doing an interview, and that interview needs to be done publicly. If the city manager is hiring somebody, totally different scenario.
Okay. We as a my assumption is we would never be in that position unless we were looking to hire a city manager, right?
you don't need to worry about the Open Meetings Act or the city manager.
Right, yeah.
You only need to worry about...
The one position we... It was just the way that one slide was worded, that was all.
Okay.
That clarified.
Tim, there's actually two positions.
The city attorney, correct, yeah, correct.
Yeah, that brings me to our city attorney. So we talked about, you know, with auditors, how often we need to review and seek...
I wouldn't change my opinion on any professional service. So that would apply to your city attorney as well. Unless you're unhappy, you know, with the advice you're getting, I don't see a need to say every 5 years, every 10 years, or every 15 years, you know, you just have to put it out to bid. Because some, there are some firms out there, whether you like it or not, will say, oh, we'll give you a rate of only $80 an hour, where everybody else is at $150 or $200. Well, you'll notice that the bill in total won't change all that much, because what your city attorney used to do in an hour now takes his other firm 3 hours to do. So, you know, they can play that game with you too. So you're not necessarily, a professional service shouldn't be based solely on the hourly rate. It should be based on the responsiveness of the service, on the quality of the service, the depth of, you know, understanding of the community. That policies factor into it.
What would be the negative aspect? So I'll just tell you from like my standpoint, locally here at Boynton City, a lot of people really want to see transparency with the local government, which I understand. And so frequently, meeting after meeting after meeting, concerns with public comment has been brought up with bids, and seeing bids on certain things, certain projects, and certain services. So in the back of your mind, you're trying to think, okay, to create transparency, what would be a negative aspect in looking for bids for like an auditor? Even though, okay, so we're going to go over bids for these auditors. Yes, our same auditor we worked for 10 years is going to make a bid, and we might have three more. But wouldn't we be able to showcase, well, you know, they're competitive, their price is outrageous, and we can have like a leg to stand on, I guess, to show we're continuing to go with this auditor that we've had for 10 years, they're still competitive, and we have a long-term relationship? Would there be a negative aspect to doing the bids?
I don't see that much of a negative, other than maybe sending the auditor or auditing firm a panic, you know,
right, yeah,
sort of thing.
Okay.
Or what may happen is the one you really want is not low bid.
Right.
So then the community says, well, you didn't pick low bid. But the reason we justify it is because of the service we get. So yeah, catch 22.
It is catch 22. And again, I think a professional service is a little bit different than, you know, buying pencils or buying reams of paper. Their price matters, but the quality of the service is probably the focus you want to have for professional service. My opinion, that's Chris Johnson's personal opinion.
Right.
That's not a legal mandate or anything.
After not going to jail.
Yeah, but that's not. You don't want to do that.
Well, I don't know if this question is too specific. If I'm asking you for a legal opinion or something like that, but we have a local issue with the marina. And there's a segment of the community that wants to propose a vote. So at what point is necessary?
In general, in Michigan,
could you wait until Marty returns?
Oh.
He stepped up for just a second.
Sure.
I'd like him to, you know, just to hear this. You want everybody to hear it.
Yeah, that's, thank you.
That's what, isn't that what I said?
No, you said he wanted to hear it.
Oh, well, because
I took it that he was
here.
Yeah.
It's been a real hot button here.
Yeah. Certain issues work that way.
Marty, I just asked Chris a question about a vote on the marina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point, or what authority do we have to put some issue like that on the ballot?
Oh, okay. Literally, you don't have any authority to put that sort of a question on a ballot. And you should confirm this with your city attorney to make sure you can rely on it. Because again, as I told you, I'm not your city attorney, you can't apply it. But Michigan law prohibits that because that's what your job is, quite frankly. It's your job to listen to the community and make a decision on that, and not, you know, put your finger up and, you know, see which way the wind's blowing at any given time. Anybody that's done advisory questions on ballots like that usually gets them knocked off the ballot by another citizens group on the other side that says, you know, it's illegal to do that, and you shouldn't put yourself in the position of having to defend something that shouldn't be done in the first place.
So would you recommend that we have our city attorney come to a city commission meeting and we deal with that question in an open meeting so the community can hear that?
Yeah, again, if your attorney has issued an opinion on it, and I don't know whether he has or not.
Yeah, I would encourage going on the Secretary of State site, Michigan Secretary of State site. It's spelled out very clear how to create a ballot initiative with petitioning at the county level and the local level. And it's very clear how a ballot vote is generated. And from my understanding, we do not have the authority to put anything.
Well, I mean, you run it, you mentioned it.
You know, the other thing, too, is you get to waive, as a commission, any attorney-client letter you got. So while it may say attorney-client privilege on it, remember it's your privilege to waive. So, and, you know, every municipal attorney that I know understands that. You know, it's not, the privilege isn't to protect me, it's to protect the community, depending on what's in the letter. Now, please don't do this because it would violate the law. You know, you don't want that to be, you know, especially if you decide to still do it, even though your attorney says don't do it, you don't want that. But if, you know, have a conversation, again, I don't know what stage you're at with that, getting an opinion on it from your city attorney, but just, you know, disclosing it. Recently in Ann Arbor, they decided they wanted to put a vaccine mandate in for all city employees, period. And what they did was go to a very large firm that handles municipal issues. That person drafted up a letter, and then the city council waived attorney-client privilege it, and they ended up on the front page of the Ann Arbor News, you know, with the city attorney's opinion on it, which was, yes, you can go ahead and require, you know, vaccination. And of course, the Michigan or the U.S. Supreme Court just upheld that for, you know, individual, not for the federal government to mandate it, but each individual company could. And that would include. So basically, the attorney was writing the letter with the specific idea that it's going to be released to the public. He knew that that was going to happen. And he drafted a really good opinion. I've read it and I thought it was a really good job.
Okay. Does anybody else have questions? I mean, this is really the time to do it.
No, that's the only thing I had. It wasn't ringing the bell. I just wanted to confirm from that standpoint.
Yeah.
Chris, the Pappy, you have some information about the CAP Pap. You have three members here that have never been to one of our league conferences. Anything you want to say about it? I know we just got the emails on it today, too.
Our capital conference is one of the, I think, as mayor, it was one of the best things I was attending on an annual basis because it really highlights what's going on, especially in Lansing. And lots of strange things have been happening in Lansing of late. I'll give you a pretty comprehensive review from our state federal affairs folks. Those four people are, I think, amazing in terms of what they get accomplished for people. We're probably the only lobbying organization in Lansing that does not contribute financially to anybody's campaign. So we're not trying to buy them, but we are trying to constantly give them your opinion as to what's going on, like in the short-term rental, and they don't like that necessarily, but they got here. Anyway, it's kind of like public comment section of a meeting, you know, they not want to hear it, but we got to give it to them anyway. So you really find out a lot of what's going on in Lansing as a result of the Capitol Conference. It's only a day long, but the material that you get is pretty valuable. Even if you're only sending one member down and share the information, that's very valuable. So it was always something I attended while I was mayor, just because the amount of information on so many different topics was good. I strongly recommend it. Then we also have an evaluation form if you fill that out. Be kind.
You want this before you guys leave?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can just go back in that pile. I can grab it.
You meant me, Mike.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yeah, but we could just give it to Mike and he could get it.
No, it works.
What's the title? Should the young girls have it?
Life saving position training?
I'll figure it out.
The second is a local government.
Hughes, as you call the meeting to order, and I don't think there's anything else that's going to be coming for you. Are you ready for an adjournment?
Hi, Bob.